This last beautiful verse from the Bhagavad Gita that Greg just read to us is from the 18th chapter, which is the last chapter of the Gita, and in fact it's toward the end of the 18th chapter, so it's all of the instruction of the Bhagavad Gita has come before Krishna says these words, and so they have profound and exquisite meaning just standing alone, but in the context they have even more force. And Paradaswami did it with Moses sent the law, Christ sent the grace. Of course, that verse is often interpreted in a sectarian way, which is that you can't become free unless you accept Jesus Christ as your only Savior, that Moses just sent a piece of it, but it wasn't really finished until Jesus sent it. It doesn't have that kind of a sectarian meaning, but I'll come back to that in a minute. All through the Bhagavad Gita and all those many verses that come before, Krishna is giving Arjuna, his disciple, an enormous spectrum of all the possibilities that the soul can take on in order to free itself from the delusive hold that ego has on us. Master described ego as the infinite soul falsely identified with the physical body. In other words, we take our divine nature, we commit it to a limited material form, and then we lose contact with what we really are. This is very distinctly different than the usually accepted more Western way of talking, emphasized even more by Darwin, that we're actually limited and dark and cursed by sin and, in fact, animalistic in our real nature, and we manage barely to get our nose above water and cease to be so barbaric, and then in some kind of peculiar sort of grace, God will pluck us out of that mud puddle and make us free forever. And free forever is just basically this life lived in the astral world. One of my Catholic friends told me that when he was a schoolboy, the nuns used to actually try to get them to behave better on the basis of then, when they died, they would have a bigger house in heaven. Needless to say, as soon as he was able, he didn't follow that faith anymore. It just seemed like such a preposterous promise, and the sacrifice being asked of him just didn't seem worth it as far as he was concerned. It just, you know, take the pleasure in hand and seize it instead of for this unknown comfort later on. But the whole way the orientation of the East is that our nature is gold, that we're pure gold in ourselves, and that is the definition of our being. And then we have, by our own inattention, false desires, covered that gold with mud. But you can take a nugget of gold and you can bury it in tar, and still, when you take all that away from it, the essence of the gold remains. It was the darkness that was the illusion at all times. Now, in the Bhagavad Gita, the story is Arjuna is facing this enormous battle, and the Bhagavad Gita is a chapter in this huge epic called the Mahabharata, which most of you know, and it's a war between cousins. It's a historical story, but it's also symbolic, that the self-divided one family, which is the different aspects of one's own inner nature, sooner or later, in our effort to free the gold nugget from the tar, the two forces come, they clash, because you cannot have both the pure gold and the tar together. You know, the tar will obscure it, or it has to be peeled away, and it's not necessarily easy to get it off, but it has to be taken off in order for the gold to shine. And even though the two have lived intertwined for as long as we can remember, pretty much, that doesn't mean that they are one. But we can become sentimentally attached to the comfort of just being what we've always been. You know, a man, a woman, even in one lifetime, the level of attachment or comfortableness that develops for as we are. It's when years ago, before I ever even had a passport, what to speak of, had traveled outside of this country, Swami Kriyananda, who was born in Europe and had crossed the ocean 6 times, I think, before he was 10 years old. 6 months was the first time he took a transatlantic voyage from Romania, where he was born, to America. He used to make statements that I just didn't understand. He would say, you know, you can sit in Switzerland, you see people come into a cafe, before people even open their mouths, you know what country they're from. Because the whole culture, they've just taken it on. And I used to think that was much too gross of a generalization until I traveled. And, you know, you could just sort of look around and you just play the game. Some are more obvious than others. The British and the Germans tend to really stand out. So do the Italians. There's just this sort of, well, Bob, this way of being. It's not in their souls. It's not even in their bodies. It's just what they've been taught. People look a great deal alike these days. You know, sometimes there's specific features, but it's really much more in just the attitude toward life that they've accepted. And then Swamiji pointed out, every once in a while, you see someone who's just completely unidentifiable because they are so strongly themselves that no matter what culture they've been in. And Swami's capacity is he doesn't have that same commitment to the superficial. He lives more in the essence, and he passes for a native in many, many countries. You know, sometimes they'll think he's been out of his country for a while, and so his language may be a little rusty. But they're always, in Italy, one of his friends said to him, one of the storekeepers said, I know you're Italian, but where do all these people come from? You know, no, I'm not Italian, when you ask Swami, he says he doesn't belong anywhere. Even when people ask him where he lives, he just sort of can't quite give an answer because all of those definitions have been taken away. But most of us just live in what we're used to. I expressed to you all recently, last summer, David and I, after 17 years living in one apartment in our community, we moved about 100 yards. I mean, that's all, just 100 yards. But the sense of loss of self that came over me when I had to change my dwelling, well, all I can say, it was humbling to the point of being humiliating. Just to realize that just having lived, you know, day by day and brushed my teeth at the same sink and looked out at the same scene for breakfast and walked up the same stairs, it just become like comfortable. In Autobiography of a Yogi, Swami Master talks about when he was a young boy and he took his cousin and they ran away to the Himalayas, and his brother Ananta thwarted their plot and they were picked up by the police and taken back to their families because they were just young boys. And Yogananda remained steadfast in his determination to escape from the family and be a yogi in the Himalayas. But he speaks about how his cousin was basking in the familial warmth, is how he described it. When his brother or his father came to grab him, Yogananda's sort of trying to persuade him, we can still sneak away. But then he looks at his cousin and he sees his cousin is sort of snuggled back up to being, you know, a comfortable little boy in his parents' house, and all the adventure of being a big yogi doesn't attract him anymore. Well, again and again and again, incarnation after incarnation, we play out this same drama of rising for a time to a perception of our true nature, and just a little bit of the blackness parts away and we see the solid gold of our true nature. And more than that, we feel the extraordinary sense of fulfillment and safety and love that brings with it. It's not that we seek this out to please some god or even to escape from hell or anything like that. It's simply the longing of our own souls. Everything in creation longs to merge back with the infinite, to get over this separation. And the Bhagavad Gita is Arjuna faced in this epic tale with the need literally to pick up his weapons and to slay his close relations, those with whom he has lived and loved and played and always been with, and now circumstances have forced them into opposition. And absolutely nothing that Arjuna and his brothers have tried have been able to harmonize that opposition, because ultimately, that's what it is, that one or the other has to give way, that both can't survive together. But Arjuna is captured by the familial warmth. How, life is not worth living. Why, how could I possibly be happy if I renounce and destroy all these things that I think of as part of myself? And the whole Bhagavad Gita is Krishna then explaining to Arjuna both how and why this is a good idea. And then the Gita is filled with all these techniques, fire ceremonies, meditation, right action, right attitude, karma yoga, just everything, how to regard everything in this world. We're going to do classes for weeks and weeks on all those different verses, because every aspect of the spiritual path is covered. When Swami Kriyananda last year published his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, it was just an extraordinary, is an extraordinary book. Every aspect of the spiritual path is taught in the Bhagavad Gita. The Gita itself is very short. The commentary on it is not short, because there's so much to say. And after all of that, then Krishna says to Arjuna, because you're such a good devotee, I'm going to tell you the final secret. And the final secret, he actually says, is forget everything else I've said. Just give me your heart. Just love me. Just put me at the center of your altar. Concentrate on nothing else, and everything else will follow from that. And it's an extraordinary teaching, really. It's the teaching of devotion and the teaching of love. Now, back when we're at the Bible verse, which we're also talking about today, it wasn't that Moses did not teach the Jewish people to love, because love is the power that holds the whole universe together. It's just that by the time Jesus incarnated, that whole teaching of love had been lost in favor of this dogmatic teaching that this is how you must behave, and it's all about rules and the mind. And like all true spiritual traditions, after a while, become a subject to the lower understanding of sincere but unenlightened people who gradually make it over in their own image. That's what you see all around you now. That's why people protest that there must be something wrong with religion. Look how many people have been killed in the name of Christ. Look how many people are now being killed in the name of Muhammad. You know, the Buddhists haven't been quite as bad, but there have been Buddhist warriors here and there too who have made a mess of things. People are always killing each other for one thing or another. And, you know, people are talking now about the great mistake we've made in Iraq was to fail to appreciate that the country has always been divided against itself for centuries and centuries and centuries. You have these two sides that just feel in the name of their God they have to hate each other. This has nothing to do with God. This is just nothing to do with God. This is not what true spirituality is. True spirituality is always the experience that you have of the oneness of creation, and then the behavior that comes from that. But the spirituality is not the behavior. The spirituality is the experience. And that's what Jesus came to bring again to the Jewish people, to the Gentiles, to all people, to everyone who was confused from it. The Jews attracted him because within the core of that teaching was the truth. It had just been lost. And so Jesus came to resurrect it. And so that's how they put it. Moses brought the law, but truth and grace came through Jesus Christ. Moses brought the grace, but people had turned their back on it. But through the Christ consciousness, and Swamiji tries to express this to us, it's not easy to understand, because we get so between our inner experience and our outer experience, it's not always easy to keep them so separated. But what Master is trying to say, what Christ was trying to say in that statement, what's trying to be said about Christ, is the only thing that actually matters is consciousness. That if you look to your consciousness, take care of your consciousness, absolutely everything else will follow from that. I was always enjoyed Haridas, the man who lived here for a few years. Many of you know him well. After knowing Haridas for many, many years, he always has had a unique way of moving through the world. But when he came to live here, I really tried to understand what was the internal logic of the way that he lived, because it was always seemed a little bit different than the logic that I was using. And I began to become aware that it was really very, very self-consistent, which is somewhere along the way in the spiritual path, he realized that the only thing that mattered was his state of consciousness. Now, you have to understand how absolutely vitally important this is, because all you're ever expressing to people is your state of consciousness. No matter what words you put on it, no matter what actions you actually think you're putting out, just think about it for a minute. When somebody talks to you and talks to you like they're all nice and they're real nice to you, but inside they're very annoyed with you, or if they're trying to have a happy, positive attitude, but you know that they're really feeling depressed or angry for some reason, one is never fooled. You might not be able to perceive it right away, but sooner or later, what's actually underneath there will really come out. I know that there's this book I saw recently. I think it's fairly well known now. It's about communication between mothers and teenage daughters. And the title of the book is, "You're Gonna Wear That?" You know? Which, of course, a mother could say so casually, "You're gonna wear that?" But the child, here's just a whole story. What I read once called the meta message behind that whole remark. How many times have you said something you thought was innocent, but then in fact you get a tremendous reaction? And if you're honest enough, almost always behind your remark, which you carefully couched, is this whole sort of exactly what you're being called for. I remember once I was accused of doing something quite inappropriate, and I was absolutely innocent. And at first, I was going to be outraged at the accusation, but then I realized that I hadn't actually done it, but I might have, you know, that I was perfectly capable of doing it. And someone was almost like it was a preemptive strike to accuse me of having misbehaved when I hadn't, but the karma was in me. Somebody looked at me and saw me capable of it, and then they accused me of it. Swamiji once reprimanded David and I for something we didn't do at all, but somebody had falsely reported to him that we did after he had scolded us, which we took very nicely because David was there and he's much calmer than I. And I took a lead from him and took it very nicely. A few days later, I said, "Swamiji, you know, of course, that never happened." He said, "I know." He said, "But the mere fact that someone might even say it about you," he said, "you should pay attention to that." Isn't that interesting? Because the consciousness was there, the vibration was there. Maybe we were disciplining it, but we shouldn't settle for less. We shouldn't be content merely because we've managed to fool the crowd. You know, because God reads the heart. That's the point that Krishna's trying to emphasize here, and is the most important thing to understand. Divine Mother doesn't look at the show we're putting on for the world. Divine Mother is within our own consciousness and feels our actual vibrations. And the only thing that really frees us from delusion is the actual inner experience of our true nature. I've learned this over the years, and I've told you many times, but it's such a vivid story to me in so many different forms, that so much of what I perceive and admire in Swamiji and think is the result of willpower is not the result of willpower. It's a complete different perception of reality. Once when I was having a great deal of trouble with this woman who was very overbearing, and of course her overbearingness conflicted with mine. And it was just so frustrating to me because she constantly insisted on not listening to me. And I always was, you know, she had enough willpower that I couldn't get around it. And I mean, I could describe it differently than that, but that was in essence what was happening. And when I said to Swami, "I'm having such a difficult time working with this woman, because she's so overbearing." And Swami says, "Oh, she treats me just the same way," he said. "But," he said, "when I'm with her," he said, "I just don't bother to have a personality." He said, "I don't need," and he didn't mean that he gave up his values or he gave up things that were really important, but a great deal of what we were just dealing with is her habit of moving through the world and my habit of moving through the world. He said, "Why have a habit like that? Why have to be a certain way? Why not just be able to let yourself flow with the way other people are?" And years later, when I really began to understand what he had said to me, I repeated it back to him with gratitude. "It was so helpful to me, sir, that idea of not having a personality." Then Swami just, he always sort of doubles the lesson. He looked very puzzled and he said, "But I don't have a personality." Just like, "What are you talking about?" And of course, he appears to have a personality. He's quite charming. He has all these different ways of being. But there's no habit there. It's merely just whatever's needed in the circumstances. If silence is needed, then silence is offered. If speaking is needed, speaking is offered. If softness is needed, softness is offered. Because all these things belong to us. Now, this is like right behavior. I'm gracious. I'm kind. I've been trained by my mother. I have good manners. I remember once someone said to Swamiji that he'd read this wonderful technique of leadership. If you have to correct someone, always tell them a few things they've done right first. Swami looked almost horror-stricken. His response was, "That's so manipulative." He said, "And anybody who's at all sensitive will see right through it. You know, and then they'll question your sincerity about everything that you say, if you're just being nice to them so that you can hack at them." I mean, this is how people teach you to behave. They teach you how to negotiate. They teach you how to guide people. But what they're not teaching you is how to love. How to genuinely, with your whole heart, look at other people and see your own self. See the divine self. This is not something that can be faked. And when you encounter that, the reality of life is so entirely different. There's been a few friends in my life. But I've had a few friends in my life that I've deliberately cultivated an awareness of their consciousness because I have seen in them, particularly this very quality, but in several cases, simply qualities of consciousness. Haridas is one of those people that is so attractive, but so not in my own natural flow, you know, and just practicing having no personality, making friends with people who are not at all like you, and just being in their rhythm. It's sort of fun sometimes. Sometimes I like to imitate people who have peculiar walks or peculiar manners of speaking, just to try to understand what kind of a consciousness would bring that out. I was watching these teenage boys walking, you know, kind of how they walk. I thought, like, what would make a person walk like that? Am I exaggerating it? I don't think so. You know, I think it's all movement from the lower chakras is what it really is. And there's just so much downward, you know, energy. That's the music that they like too. You know, it goes like that. But you can sort of like, I mean, I do it for fun. You have to be a little careful sometime when you're imitating somebody right in front of you. But you kind of get a feeling for what that consciousness would be like. It puts you inside their reality. And once you get inside someone's reality, it's the oddest thing, partly because I've done a lot of counseling through the years, and I've just had a lot of opportunity to have people sit in front of me and really open their hearts. In fact, when I was writing this book about Swamiji, I went up to Ananda Village particularly, and over the course of a couple of weeks, I interviewed more than 50 people. And I asked them to talk to me about their experiences with Swami Kriyananda, which of course is something very close to their heart. Now, people who are that dedicated to the spiritual path are good people. Doesn't matter how many faults and limitations or how many completely idiotic things they may have done in their life. Doesn't matter, they're good people. But it was just amazing to me. You stand inside anybody's consciousness and just like all sense of judgment just disappears. Because every single person who lives is just moving in the same reality that all the rest of us are moving in. They're just trying hard to find a place in this world and to be happy. You know, to escape whatever misery has been imposed upon them and just find a way to be happy. And we, you know, look for all different ways. We just get our little scenes so organized. We're just like little children getting our little dollies all set up and our little tea parties and just how exactly it has to be. And the masters look at us and we're doing just the same. We're getting our little car and we're getting our little house. We're getting our little husband and our little wife. And then we get it all set up. You notice how little children are? It's all set up. Come, Mommy, see, I have it all set up. And we're just sitting there like that and we have it all set up. We go into our closet and everything's all arranged. I mean, we have to live. We have to express ourselves some way. Swami has a closet. He has his clothes in his closet. He has a number of beautiful homes, you know, that he's made beautiful. It's not as if in itself, we shouldn't live in this world. We have to live. Question is, what is the consciousness? Am I doing this for my own, to make everything right for me? Am I doing this out of dogmatic adherence to these rules because then everything will work out? I mean, it's so confusing for people when that begins to break down. But I did everything right. I went to church all the time. There was a very moving story that's out in several books of, this was a number of years ago, 25 years ago maybe, some of you may remember, there was a rugby team from South America that the plane crashed in the Andes, and they lived for 70 days. And then finally one of the men walked out of the Andes, just went, climbed over these mountains, an unbelievable tale. But I recently read an account of from the man who walked out, and it was interesting because the captain of their team was a very charismatic man, tremendously respected by everyone. I mean, these were all friends. These are young men, and they were good friends. And when they found themselves in this terrible crisis, the man who was the captain stepped into a leadership role. And he played it out, you know, beautifully, and was a tremendous source of courage and comfort for all of them. He was also a very devout Catholic in a very traditional sense, and in fact, he lived a more restrained and moral life than the other players, and it was a little bit of a joke between them, but he had this very firm faith in the Catholic dogma, which required more self-restraint of him. The others all went to church but didn't pay attention to everything. And he was persuaded that because he'd done everything right and they were doing everything right, that they would be rescued, that they would be searched for and they would be rescued. And for a time, they all held hope that they would be found. But then they managed to turn on a radio, get a little radio going for a very short period of time. This is all the true story. And somehow in the course of that, the news came that the search had been called off because just too much time had passed. They were too high in the mountains, and so no one was going to look for them anymore. What that created for the captain of the team, it just completely shattered his world because he'd done everything right, and he just assumed that, you know, everything else would follow. And all his strength and energy and courage and hope just disintegrated in that moment. And it disintegrated because the orderly structure of his world had been dismantled. He couldn't put that in, and soon after he died. You know, ultimately, some of them got out, but he couldn't live. He couldn't live anymore because the form had been taken away from him. It was a very interesting crisis of faith. Now, on many levels, a lot of us live with that same delusion, whether we admit it or not. You know, there always comes this point where you realize, I've done everything. Why are you still treating me this way, Lord? I know Swamiji often makes fun of wrong attitude, because if you make fun of it when it's easier than when you're tempted to have it when it's not so easy, you remember that it was a joke. Swami, when he first built the dome that is now the living room of Crystal Hermitage, but at first it was just a dome, and he built it for $5,000, and they covered it with this spray foam, very, you know, experimental building. The spray foam is still there. The problem that they didn't take into account when they sprayed it is that a geodesic dome is very flexible. And when the sun would shine on it, what? It would expand, and then at night it would contract. And the foam didn't have the same elasticity as the structure of the dome. So every day it would expand and contract, and all of that would open hairline cracks all through the thing. And during that time, we had 60 inches of rain a year during 6 months. I mean, it would just pour torrential rain, and a great deal of that rain would just pour into his house. I mean, just literally pour into his house. He had a trap door in the middle of the floor that went under the dome. It was all very rustic, and he would keep the wood under the house. And so that trap door just went literally to the outside. We would lift that trap door, and we would sweep water. You know, there'd be so much water, we'd just sweep it out of the floor and just down into that. And Swami would often say, I'm so sincere, Lord. I'm doing everything I can. Why do you keep raining in on me like this? And they tried everything to seal that dome. And from the beginning, Swami said, you have to put another roof over it. which is finally what they did. If you go to the Crystal Hermitage now and go out on the porch and look back, you realize that there's just a roof over this funky old plastic dome. It's just still sitting there. But so often in our lives, oh, I'm trying so hard, Lord. I'm doing everything I should be doing. Why aren't you keeping your half of the bargain? I say we have this sense of, what do they call it? Thwarted entitlement. They speak of rich children having a sense of thwarted entitlement. Well, that's the problem with us as devotees. We have this idea that God owes us a certain condition, owes us a certain kind of treatment, but he doesn't. He has one objective, and that objective is to purify our consciousness so that we are able to give our hearts completely to God without any fear, and therefore the attendant sense of holding on to some little piece of something. You know, we're always trying to hold on to some little piece of something. And what that means, quite simply, is to that extent we're covered with tar, and the light, we don't experience the light. This is where Krishna says, simply, if you can give your heart completely to me, nothing else is required. You can let go of every other writ and duty. Nothing else will matter. The grace will come to you. And it's so, I've been hearing Swamiji explain this for all my life, and all I can say is I'm just beginning to understand it. He tries to say to us, when you give yourself completely to God, you have more of yourself than you ever had when you were holding back. It's just an illusion that cannot be explained except by experience. And that's what the beginning of our scripture says. Grace is the experience of the truth of God's presence with us. That we are always like children clinging to the smallness of our little lives and not understanding that we can't even express our own talents when we claim them as our own. It's only when we just realize everything I'm seeking is in the divine awareness. Whatever little tiny experience you have of that, whatever little bit of grace ever touches your life, cling to that. Go back to that. Remind yourself of that. Enshrine that on the altar of your spiritual understanding. It's not about the orderliness with which you live, or the diet, or the exercise, or the way you can point to yourself as I donate regularly and I come all the time. It's entirely only. What is your consciousness? Are you doing it for love of God? Do you love God? Are you cultivating that love of God? Chanting, meditating, contemplating the greatness of the Master's gratitude, disciplining your mind away from its childish clinging to the things of this world, which can disappear in an instant. All that matters is consciousness. I watched Hari Das, and I finally began to understand, even in the middle of a meeting, if his own mind wavered slightly from kindness or sympathy, if just even the slightest little bit of judgment would come into his thought, then all of a sudden he would go on this little tangent explaining the goodness of something that no one else in the room had even questioned. You see how what a non sequitur that would seem? You're sort of all talking about this, and all of a sudden Hari Das is explaining how so-and-so is good, and this situation is wonderful, and what fine things they did, and isn't it sweet how God plays in this way? And you think, when are you going to finish so we can go back to the subject at hand? But for him, he'd never wavered off the subject. For just a moment, some little aberration had come into his consciousness. Nothing else even existed for him. He just had to solve that, and then he could go back. You know, it's just like, that's why efficiently run organizations prefer good administrators to saints, because saints are quite inconvenient. You know, they do things like that. They go off the topic, right? And they consider how you are in your inner being more important than what you're doing. But even justice, Swami writes today, is an extension of the experience of truth. It's not that justice matters, it's the experience of truth that matters, and everything else follows. All of the problems of this world, which are, in my opinion, insoluble, because God has set it up to be a very difficult place right now, There's no problems in this world. Nobody needs to be hungry. Nobody needs to be without pure water or any of these things. If the consciousness was different, everyone knows that. You pour aid into these countries and some greedy somebody or another just swoops it off and stores it in Switzerland for the time when he gets thrown out of the country. I mean, it drives you completely crazy. Unless you realize, wait a minute. Consciousness. Consciousness is more powerful than any other circumstance. My consciousness, my capacity to influence this world on the level of consciousness is limitless. Work on that level. You know, in every circumstance in your life, even if you're a political activist out there with your picket signs, do it with the right consciousness, if that's what you're meant to be. But consciousness is everything. Don't let yourself forget that for a moment. Give me your heart, Krishna says. Everything else will follow.